The conflation of biography and fiction in the reception of Jane Eyre was, it would seem, present from its inception. Following its publication, Gaskell writes in her Life of Charlotte Bronte, "The whole reading world of England was in a ferment to discover the unknown author. Conjecture as to the authorship ran about like wildfire." Ever since the publication of Elizabeth Gaskell's life, and perhaps even before it, the Brontes' lives and stories have remained a contested site of meaning and misreading. The iconic status of Jane Eyre as apparently autobiographical text, it is of course described as an autobiography, is blurred with the real biography of its author. In this paper, I want to examine the conflation of biographical and literary approaches to rereading and rewriting the Brontes, and the way in which this is figured through their material legacy. My own background and interest in this work stems from a series of critical and creative works which focus on contemporary fan fiction of Jane Eyre. The Brontes, as Anne Jameson argues in Fic, Why Fan Fiction is Taking Over the World, were themselves early proponents of fan fiction in their stories about the Duke of Wellington published in tiny homemade books which emulated Blackwood's magazine. Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea is regarded as a foundational text for both fan fiction and neo-Victorian critics, and for similar reasons. In Fic, Lev Grossman describes how Rhys spoke back to Bronte, while Anne Harleman and Mark Llewellyn, in their introduction to neo-Victorianism, The Victorians in the 21st Century, describe her book as a conscious articulation of the desire to rewrite, revision, and challenge the 19th century's assumptions and dominance. I'm particularly fascinated by this conflation of biography and narrative in contemporary reimaginings of the Brontes, because it seems to exemplify the way in which the security of coherent narrative structures and textual order as represented by the 19th century, that's Heilman and Llewellyn again, might address the contemporary fragmentation of narrative structure in historical narratives. Valerie Traub posits that we will neither find in the past a mirror image of ourselves, nor that the past is so utterly alien that we will find nothing usable in its fragmentary traces. The turn towards the biographies of the writers we reread suggests a different way of reading these stories, the construction of a different way of experiencing that profound nostalgia that reading and rereading the Bronte seems to always summon. Cora Kaplan, discussing the rise of biography in recent years, argues that biography, with its inexorable chronology, its twin foundation in embodiment and achievement, could, in the light of recent debates over the nature of historical truth, become a generic type of real history, certifying the materiality, depth, and moral authority of authors. For Kaplan, the resurgence of biography is closely allied to the return of focus on the subject, so that the romantic ideology of the self, that's Kaplan again, is once again claimed and owned by the literary imagination. In her view, theories of the death of the author have resulted in a riposte so that, this is her again, the threat has breathed new life into the idea of the author. For me, this is where fan fiction and neo-Victorian critiques begin to part company. The fetishization of authorship is more usually jettisoned in fan fiction in favor of a collaborative fan approach to creating new fandoms, alternate scenarios, pairings, and textual worlds. Describing the complex ways in which readers encounter historical texts in reading historical fiction, Kate Mitchell and Nicola Parsons suggest that critical attention to the text displaces the reader in the process of creating historical meanings. The meaning of a text thereby seeps beyond its borders and into the retellings, references, and debates it generates. Far from the past being encountered as a static form, they argue, neo-Victorian fiction offers historical text as witness. Fiction thus offers the potential, this is a quote, to animate or vivify in phantasmic form voices silenced by a historical record. By extension, the combination of a silenced and incomplete historical record with the ghostly voices restored by contemporary historical fiction constructs what they term the reading subject. the reader in this conception appears as a hinge point between the unstable meanings and questionable solidity of historical fact and the ephemeral accounts and ventriloquies summoned by a reimagined and resurrected version of history. Such severings between original written text and contemporary rereadings, and the lengths to which a reader must go to pull them together, are fundamental to the contemporary accounts of the Brontes, which I will be discussing. For Deborah Lutz, in her critical work, The Bronte Cabinet, Three Lives in Nine Objects, the Brontes become living authors once again, as she reads the traces of their lives in the objects they owned and handled. In Catherine Lowell's The Madwoman Upstairs, the Brontes are summoned repeatedly, but apparently vainly, by the strange and at times zombie-like figure of the novel's narrator, Samantha Whipple, the last living descendant of the Bronte family. In both books, the Brontes are vividly imagined figures. These long-dead authors are summoned by Lutz, the critic, and Whipple, the narrator, in a sustained attempt to bridge the divide of time that separates them and to search for clues and revelations about their lost world. This yearning to cross the divide that separates the reader from a beloved author resonates with Nadine Boehm-Schnittke and Suzanne Grus's argument that neo-Victorianism has become a means to account for manifold overlaps and intersections, the continuities and breaches between us and them. Such summoning of a long-distant period of time, they argue, risks adhering meaning to the narrative that is repeated and thus prevents a clear view of the contradictions and problems which permeate these original texts. The reader's desire to return and hence for repetition is triggered by this dual relationship of continuity and difference, or revisitation, between then and now. Moreover, neo-Victorian texts can, they say, offer powerful ways to work through traumatic traces of the past in British cultural memory. Such a reworking of the hidden narratives of Victorian texts is central to Cora Kaplan's reading of Jane Eyre. She argues in Victoriana that it remains a classic because, I quote, its themes and rhetoric have summoned up for generations of readers the powerful politics of affect at the heart of gender and modernity. Kaplan considers Jane Eyre as mnemic symbol, that is, a memorial or narrative that embodies and elicits a buried psychic conflict which cannot be resolved in the present. Rosa Kahl goes further in her analysis of Jasper Ford's Eyre Affair, arguing that the critical history of Jane Eyre shows that the novel's extraordinary power to draw the reader in has fascinated and unnerved its audiences since its publication. As George Henry Lewes remarks, the novel fastens itself upon your attention and will not leave you. Kahl states that for many readers, it creates the effect of being enchanted or even possessed. Despite initial scepticism, Virginia Woolf too felt every doubt about Bronte's world of imagination swept clean from her mind as she starts to read Jane Eyre. These uneasy accounts of the power of this first-person narrative and its hold over the reader's imagination echo a Victorian concern with the dangers of indulgent novel reading, especially on a most likely female reader. It's a taboo which Kahl argues has lost its hold due to the widespread cultural fact practices of participatory fan culture. For Kahl, the return of interest in the author and the status of his or her work is first and foremost apt to make us realise the might of the reader. What does it mean to rewrite and reread the Brontes then, both their lives and works? And I want to consider the work of Lutz and Lowell in order to explore the resonance of these modes of engagement with the Brontes' work and with their biographies. Lowell's novel, The Madwoman Upstairs, presents its heroine, Samantha Whipple, as an explicitly unreliable narrator who is also the last remaining descendant of the Brontes. She is sent to study literature at Oxford by an eccentric will left by her father, ostensibly in order to search for a mysterious family inheritance described only as the warnings of experience. The novel engages with the legacy of the Brontes in numerous ways, from its title, which references Bertha Mason, to its very last line, which repeats the last line of Anne Bronte's novel Agnes Grey. It explicitly places its heroine within the world of a Bronte novel, drawing on storylines, images, characters, and landscapes associated with their work. It also summons the figures of the Brontes as real people whom she has viewed throughout her childhood as friends and confidants. Her family relationship to them gives a proprietorial and authoritative tone to the accounts of the Brontes and gives a sense of authenticity to her recollections. Samantha doesn't just feel as though she knows the three writers, as so many writers and readers do. Due to her family connection to the Brontes, she believes she knows them. Samantha describes the Brontes as family members with whom she shares a deeply strange and isolated childhood, with an absent mother and a stern and eccentric father. The novel continually incorporates excerpts and quotes from the Brontes' writing into the narrative through the depictions of her English literature lessons and essays whilst in Oxford and the recollections of her close reading sessions with her father. The quotations bring the prose and voice of the Brontes into vivid relief against the bizarre and puzzling mystery story in which Samantha Whipple, the character, finds herself. From the beginning of the novel, the reader is provided with copious clues that the narrator is in fact operating within the confines of a Bronte novel with its unreliable narrator. Samantha is described as an orphan. Her mother is still living but mostly absent, and she appears to be frozen in a state of grief and largely self-imposed isolation as a result of her father's death in a fire in his library. On the first page of the novel, as she arrives at Old College, Oxford, we see the heroine placed at the top of a tower originally used to quarantine victims of plague. Inside the room, the walls are covered in peeling red paint. In the corner, a horrible painting of a woman who, by the look of it, was halfway through drowning. This first scene, and in particular the portrait, offer multiple clues to the alert Bronte reader. The red room in which Jane Eyre was imprisoned as a child, the portrait of a drowning figure, which Rochester sees amongst Jane's sketches, as well as the motif of the lonely, estranged, and highly vulnerable foreign woman placed on the highest floor of the tower. However, also contains multiple clues about the ways in which this narrative will unfold and whether the legacy, the warnings of experience, which is a theme throughout the book, will be something tangible, a Bronte treasure, or just another one of my father's esoteric lessons. As the last surviving descendants of the Brontes, there is huge speculation about this legacy by other characters. Samantha states that public speculation about the missing Bronte estate had reached an all-time high in the last 20 years. Its mystery incited a dangerous curiosity within the strangely large world of Bronte fanatics. Her father's response to this attention was to leave strange trinkets all over the house so that in case any reporter did break and enter someday, they would find lots of confusing story material. Her father, however, cared only for the novels themselves. These novels are alive, and all the other books are dead, he would say. Do you understand? He used to give me lessons on them, reading from the worn copies as he made incomprehensible margin notes. I'm sure he knew something the rest of the world did not. But when I'd ask him what it was, all he'd say was, "Sammy, I'm just trying to teach you how to read." Throughout the story, Lowell is at pains to present the divergent ways of reading, reflected in the discussions about books she has with her father, who venerates the Bronte books as living entities. She's offered a very different approach to reading by her tutor, a Rochester figure, whose research focuses on the structural and grammatical integrity of texts and contends that a perfect novel is proof of authorial invisibility. Throughout the novel, they clash on the way in which they should read the books that they discuss, for literal truth or for emotional truth. The debate appears to echo that between postmodern theorists and neo-Victorian critics in its dialogue between the invisible author and the effective potency of beloved authors such as the Brontes. Finally, I want to look briefly at one other character who becomes central to these conversations, Sir John Barker, the former Cambridge professor and present curator of the Bronte Parsonage and Museum, who coins the term the vast Bronte estate when he writes an article accusing her father of hoarding an enormous wealth of primary sources. Her father explains to her that he is a perfect example of a man who A, didn't know how to read, and B, didn't know how to think. Barker is a character who echoes the real T.J. Wise, the infamous literary collector and forger, in his obsessive quest to acquire Bronte artifacts. Barker chooses to invest meaning, metaphoric and literal wealth, in the material possessions of the Brontes rather than in their books. When Samantha visits him at the Parsonage Museum at the end of a long, fruitless quest to find her father, she feels a growing despair. Emily, Charlotte and Anne had never seemed further away. This house was dead. When Samantha complains to Barker about the sterility of the museum, he answers, "You read too many novels." The Parsonage and its collection of objects does not offer sanctuary or a link between Samantha, the reader, and her adoptive sisters. Instead, the effort of resuscitating my relatives was exhausting. I had a feeling that Emily did not want to be awakened. Somewhere, I just knew she was giving me the finger. In Lowell's book, the Brontes' living novels and their effective histories appear to take precedence as a way of negotiating with the painful histories of both the reader and the writer. Bronte relics represent an association with death and loss, the material object emptied out and carrying the aura of emptiness and grief. One of the lessons of the warnings of experience appears to be in knowing how to read, how to be a good reader, able to broken connections between the worlds of the authors you read and your own, and to make restitution in so doing. Deborah Lutz, in her work of literary theory, The Bronte Cabinet, uses the same objects so repellent to Samantha Whipple to summon a lived sense of the Brontes, which Claire Harmon argues weaves a kind of magic around the Brontes' possessions and evokes their lives, works, and legacies. Using the books explicitly as a mechanism by which she feels she knows the Brontes, Lutz makes a claim similar to Samantha's when she says that there are few books I'd rather carry me late into the night than Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights and Villette, few books whose worlds I'd rather crawl into and inhabit. I have even felt somehow known by their heroines, as if they might recognise me when I enter their spheres. The written word thus gives access to a deep sense of connection with the lost author. However, for Lutz, this experience is deepened and extended by her contact with the material things possessed by the Brontes. Her profound sense of intimacy makes her want to come closer still. So alive are these novels that I wish I could resurrect the Brontes themselves, their daily living and breathing, their material presence. Lutz's project in this book, then, is to resurrect the Brontes in some form, to call them back for a brief moment before the door shuts for good. The author's corporeal reality in the past, the traces of their bodies, their hands, becomes a highly charged way of reading both their lives and their texts. For Lutz, their writing is a memento of the hand moving across the page, while Charlotte's letters offer a vivid sense of the page's talismanic qualities, sewing together those miniature books as a child, handwriting and the autograph transmitting personality, perhaps a bit of the soul. The touch and warmth of the writer's skin could be carried in a letter. In her essay, Sorting, Morphing, and Mourning, Hilary Shaw points to the link between Victorian responses to physical and formal immateriality and contemporary concerns with the seemingly insubstantial yet historically haunted materials worked over by contemporary culture. It is an approach to bridging the gap of longing brought by this form of reading that is not without ethical risk, as Elodie Rousselot points out. The strangeness of the past, like that of the Orient, makes it simultaneously an object of allure and repulsion, fascination and rejection. Such contradictory readings are in fact very revealing of the motives and preoccupations of the present. Lutz acknowledges these contradictions at the very heart of her project to bring the Brontes to life through their objects when she states that using physical remains to retrieve history functions imperfectly, if at all. This one moment of doubt is mostly overshadowed by Lutz's earnest attempts at resurrection through the study of the Bronte's objects and the ways in which they were used and understood in their time. You might argue that following Patricia Dunker's assessment of neo-Victorian writers, that Lutz figures here as an illusionist in this work, offering a deliberate, transparent deception. Rosa Carl, in her discussion of the potency of Jane Eyre as originary text, cites the souvenir's capacity to internalise something that is external. It allows us to participate personally in what is ontologically inaccessible. The desire to resurrect the Brontes achieves precisely this sense of impossibility, but there is also a kind of queasy intimacy with the lost bodies of the dead Brontes that summons Emily's ghost in The Madwoman Upstairs, giving Samantha the finger as she tries to resurrect her. To conclude, Lutz's readings are compelling and I am gripped by their deeply evocative summoning, their attempt to break down the barriers that separate this reader from these iconic writers. Lowell's book mostly maintains an ironic distance from the fetishizing capabilities of this reader. However, for me, Lutz's deep immersion of the reader in the shadowy world of objects used by long-dead authors raises a number of questions about the provenance of the objects she described. I want to know more, for example, about the origins of the rosewood desk Charlotte wrote on. Who made it? Who harvested the rosewood from which it is made? Did Charlotte know the origins of this object? And was she aware that the rosewood, in all likelihood, was harvested in Jamaica? How fascinating and redolent to find that the fiery character of Bertha Mason, with all the conflicts and mnemic symbols she summons, sprang to life on a desk made from wood from the country from which she also came. The real, vivid, and deeply contradictory image of one of Charlotte Bronte's most iconic characters thus rapidly eclipses the material world of the author.